Hello, welcome to Making Creativity Pay, the podcast where we talk to people in creative industries about how they promote and market their work. I'm Dan Barnett, and on this episode, I will be speaking to journalist Fergus Morgan. This is the second half of my chat with Fergus. In the previous episode, we discussed his experiences of being a freelance theatre journalist, and in this episode, we focused more on the Edinburgh Fringe, both in terms of his experience as a reviewer and also about the future of the Fringe in general. I started out by asking Fergus to give us a quick introduction about himself and his work.
My name's Fergus Morgan. I am a journalist, a freelance journalist. I write about theatre mostly. I have various ongoing gigs. I'm the Stages Scotland correspondent. That's where I do most of my work. But I have also written for the Financial Times, the Evening Standard, the Scotsman, various other Time Out, various other publications.
So, talk about the Fringe, obviously. Yes, so we're talking now. It's late August. Fringe has just finished. As an overarching feel, how was this year compared to, you know, last year and pre-COVID? I know that's a big question.
That is a huge question. For me personally, it was perhaps not my most stressful year because I've got better at dealing with the stress of it, but I think it was probably certainly my busiest, certainly my most lucrative ever festival, my most lucrative ever month, I think, professionally, which is nice. As to how the festival itself went, it was the fifth biggest festival ever. There were just under 2.5 million tickets were issued, which doesn't quite mean sold, apparently, but were issued. Most of them were sold, which makes it a little bit bigger than last year when it was still recovering from COVID. Not quite as big as 2019. It was still about 19% smaller than 2019 when over 3 million tickets were sold for the first time. It's also smaller than the festivals in 2018, 2017, and 2016 as well. So we're at kind of 2015 levels of size. I don't know. I have such qualms with the way that the Fringe Society trumpets the number of tickets that it's sold as a metric by which to measure the festival, because it's such a huge sprawling event that encompasses so many different venues and professionals and careers and all sorts of things. And it just seems to say, oh, it was a success because we sold more tickets than last year.
Yeah.
Belies a lot of the stuff that's going wrong underneath the surface. Now, the Fringe Society is very open about this, and I have a huge amount of sympathy with the Fringe Society, actually, because they get a lot of crap thrown at them, and they are limited in what they can achieve because they are not in charge of any venues. They do not receive a huge government subsidy. They have very few levers that they can pull to negotiate this huge ocean liner of a festival. But that said, I think there is something wrong in just championing size over quality. Because what that statistic tells you, 2.5 million tickets sold. All right, how many of those tickets were sold to big comedians who everybody is already familiar with and are selling out massive venues every night of the festival? How many of those tickets were sold to emerging artists or the people that the Fringe Festival was always supposed to be about? How many of those were for disabled artists or artists of colour? How many of those artists came to the festival and made a profit? How many of those artists came to the festival and made a loss? What about their mental health? How many of those artists left the festival at the end of August and felt like they'd achieved something or felt good about themselves? How many of them got on the train home and felt shit, like they'd wasted thousands and thousands of pounds and not achieved anything? I think, when people ask me, sorry, that's a very long, rambling answer to your question. When people ask me how the festival went, I have no idea how to answer it, to be honest, because it's so big and it's so multifarious that there is no simple answer to that question.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me as an outsider looking at it, the thing that I've discussed on previous episodes as well is that, you know, doing 26, 28 days with, you know, a couple of previews at the end, doing the 28th the day after, you know, you're doing 20 plus shows, which is fine if you're, let's say, a gigging comedian where you're used to working several nights a week. You kind of develop it, and then you can kind of do it every day. But if you've almost felt forced to do the whole month because of, you know, that's the only way you can get a decent room, and you're either not ready professionally, financially, mentally, whatever, that can be a real drain.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I go to see David O'Doherty every year because I love him, and he always says he loves August. And quite right too, because he sells out one of the biggest theatres at the festival with probably close to 1,000 people in it, maybe not quite that much, maybe about 500 people in it, every night for a month, and presumably makes a hell of a lot of money doing it and has a great time. There are people that come to the festival and have to take a break from their own job, so they're not even earning and they're spending money to be here for a whole month. But then there are people that come to the festival who are well supported by schemes or by theatres and the other parts of the country who are being paid a wage to be here. They get a fee for their run at the Edinburgh Fringe, and they probably have an all right time most of the time. I think 28 is a long time. And do you know what? I published a piece in the Stage at the beginning of the festival where I interviewed a bunch of people involved in it, producers, artists, actors, journalists, critics, all sorts of people, including venue bosses as well, and Shona McCarthy, who runs the Fringe Society. And I asked them, what do you think would make the Fringe better? How could you improve it? And the most interesting suggestions for me were the ones that were radical, but they didn't compromise on the open access nature of the Fringe, i.e. anyone can come and perform here if they want to, which is kind of, at its heart, that's what it is. It's the Fringe Society likes to say it's a stage for everyone and a seat for everyone or something like that. So those suggestions, and one of them, I think it was Ellie Keel, the producer that suggested it, was limit the number of performances any single show can do. And it seems to me that that would, in one fell stroke, solve so many problems that the Fringe Festival faces, the Edinburgh Fringe faces. It would free up a whole lot of beds in the city because people were only here for a week instead of 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It would mean that the festivals were suddenly affordable to a lot more people because you're only paying to be here for a week instead of 3 weeks. But you would still be able to come if you wanted to. And there would still be more venue space. And in fact, more people could come. So the festival wouldn't get bigger in terms of the number of performances, individual performances necessarily, but it would get bigger in terms of the number of shows. So actually, as a showcase for the world's performing arts, it would be better. And it would be better for people's mental health. And it would be better for affordability. And it would be better for Edinburgh itself, because there'd be more room in the city and it would feel less crowded half the time. It seemed to make a hell of a lot of sense to me.
I guess the one issue with that is, you know, I'd imagine the big players like having their rooms booked out to one person, one act, and, you know, it's kind of a lot simpler that way.
Well, that's one of the big defining conflicts at the heart of the festival, is that people are in it to make a profit, that some of these venue chains make a hell of a lot of money. Like Edinburgh University makes a hell of a lot of money. There are the landlords of Edinburgh make a hell of a lot of money. And it's very difficult to square the kind of open access, not-for-profit idea at the heart of the Fringe with the commercialization of it. With the commercialization of the accommodation situation, with the commercialization of the performance situation, with the fact that some of these companies have shareholders they've got to care about. And that's, to me, that's the kind of defining issue at the heart of the Fringe. And yeah, and it's the issue that I think would take some radical thinking to solve properly.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people I spoke to on a previous episode, she long time goer to the Fringe, loved it, always wanted to do it. She's in her 40s now and thought, you know, this is what I really want to do. And she came up, did three nights. So I think like Friday, Saturday, Sunday night. So it's enough to scratch an itch, feel you've done it, feel you've been part of it, but it's not going to kill you financially or physically or mentally, that kind of stuff.
The difficulty, I suppose, one objection people would have to that idea is that they might not get their show seen by as many people as they would like to. Mm. When you're a member of the media or you're kind of industry professional programmer producer type up here seeing shows, looking to book them in your venue or looking to write about them in your theatre newsletter, you only have a certain number of hours in the day to see shows and a certain number of, you know, days in the month to see them. So you inevitably miss a lot of stuff. And I suppose if you were only up here for a week, would worry that you're not exposing yourself to as many people as possible, figuratively, unless you've got a kind of weird performance.
It depends on the show.
Yeah, it does. So I suppose that would be an objection. But then perversely, if a show, I think that kind of almost works the other way around as well, in a kind of paradox. If someone emails me and tells me, oh, I'm coming up to the Edinburgh Fringe, but I'm only doing a week or something like that, I actually make a point of seeing that show because the fact that it's got a limited run at the festival means that I make it more of a priority. Whereas if someone tells me, oh, I'm there for the whole month, I sort of think, oh, I'll catch it at some point, I'll catch it at some point, I'll catch it at some point. And then the festival ends and I've never actually booked in to see it. So I don't know. I think it's a good idea. I think more people should do it.
Yeah. Within that, I mean, how important do you think reviews are in the whole thing? And obviously the issue of you can't review everyone on day one. So, you know, some people, you know, I see someone getting a review, you know, the last day of their Fringe or even afterwards, you know, and it's good to still have a review and it's still, you know, it's not like everything finishes and your work disappears afterwards. But obviously it'd be much better on the 2nd of August to have a 4-star review somewhere that you can then push the rest of the month.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can see it. That's why people kind of stick stars on their poster after they've got a review. You know, their posters around town and they kind of sellotape printouts of reviews to it. So obviously reviews are one factor that drives people towards shows. There's very little research around this, and I kind of find it fascinating the way different festival goers navigate the fringe. I would never buy a ticket based on a flyer that someone gave me, but lots of people do. Lots of people roll off the train at Waverley, grab a flyer and go and see what's next. I would like to see a really in-depth survey. Maybe there is one and I'm not aware of it. That's probably the case. But I don't know if there is a lot of research into what actually drives people to see shows at the Edinburgh Fringe. I'm sure reviews are a part of it. Reviews are definitely a part, and positive media coverage is definitely a part of booking subsequent tours. And I think to an extent, it's particularly in the kind of fringe theatre world I work in, media coverage has a duty in leading the conversation about shows. Producers and programmers then follow in its wake. So I certainly think reviews matter in that context, yeah. But then it's difficult. It's kind of galling as a critic to feel like the only reason you're wanted in a show is to give it 4 stars, and they don't really care about what you write as long as you give them some stars that they can then put, and some nice quotes that they can put on a poster, or they can put in a package that they can then sell to programmers.
Yeah, and in terms of your reviews, what tips the balance between a 3 and a 4 star? Because that seems to be the key, you know. Different people, you know, they'll always pick the Fleabag one. Oh, that had 3 stars in The Guardian. You know, anything can get 3 stars. But it's like a kind of big tipping point between 3 stars, yeah, 4 stars. Mm. You know, it does seem to be quite a big difference. And what kind of what tips you over?
Well, you long for a kind of intelligent reader who can read a 3-star review and realize that it's positive and that it's worth seeing, or they can read a 3-star review and kind of read between the lines that you didn't actually enjoy yourself. Difference between a 3-star and a 4-star. I don't know. It's got probably level of enjoyment. I don't know. I don't pay that much attention to star ratings, to be honest. I walk out of a show and I think, oh, that feels like a 4-star. But then I walk out of some shows and I've had a great time and I think, this feels like a 3-star show. Even though the fact that I've had a really wonderful time and I've laughed or something like that, there's something not cohesive about the concept, or the script isn't quite polished enough, or the plot doesn't develop well enough, or that actor wasn't that great at delivering it. And likewise, when giving a kind of 5-star show, not everything in a 5-star show has to be perfect. It can have flaws. But for me, a 5-star show is something that has something in it that is remarkable, that took my breath away, that was, I've never thought, an idea that I've never seen expressed in that way, or I've never seen before. And there can be other stuff wrong with it, but if it has that kind of sparkle, then it's a 5-star show for me. Other critics will think differently. And that's the other thing, is that there's so many different people giving out star ratings, and you've no idea who half of these people are, or what their particular priorities or preferences are. So, I don't know, star ratings are such a minefield, to be honest.
But I guess it's kind of where we are in general, is that, you know, yes, you could write 500 words on something, but someone will go, well, is it 3 or 4 star? And that's all they'll want to take away from it. Which, yeah, I know it's not what you want to hear.
To be honest, I understand it as well. Like, I wrote a thing, it's so hard, but I'm not going to, it sounds like this is tiny violin territory, I wrote, but it's very hard to be a critic at the festival, particularly when people have spent so much money and invested so much time and energy in being here, and are often performing a show that is kind of about a topic that they might have personal experience of, and so they might be feeling kind of acutely vulnerable about. They're feeling financially vulnerable, they're feeling emotionally vulnerable, and then they invite you to come and give them a rating, and it's a horrible feeling, because you know that your rating, particularly if you're writing for the Scotsman's Day or the Stage or a big publication, will have an adverse effect, if it's negative, on how well they do at the Fringe Festival. This thing, and that's not a nice situation to be in. It's such, the relationship between the reviewer and the show feels so much more direct and intimate at the festival than it does at other times of the year, when you know, perhaps if you go and see a show in a big theatre or even a little theatre, you know that in general the people will be being paid, they'll be well supported, or they should be being well supported. Whereas at the Fringe, it's such a free-for-all, and that is not the case. And so you're often saying negative things to vulnerable people. And if you're a nice person, which I'd like to think I am, that's not a comfortable situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. Spoke to Miriam, who runs Storytelling PR and also does PR for Summer Hall. And one of the things they've got, and I know Gilded Blue and some of the others have, is they support the artists. So if you buy through the Fringe website, you don't see any of that. But if you go directly to Summer Hall or one of the others, there's an option to pay an extra £2. Now, I know the Fringe Society have released the overall figures. I don't know if you've seen anything on how successful or otherwise that's been.
Do you know, I chased I chased the press offices for some this morning because Gilded Balloon did it and Summerhall did it. And I've not seen anything about how successful that's been. Presumably some people did it. I don't know anyone that actually did it. Actually, no, I tell a lie. I know two people, friends of mine, that came to the festival and paid the support the artist ticket price. I don't know anyone else that did, but I like the idea of it. The only thing I can tell you is that I got the Gilded Balloons press release this morning announcing the end of the festival and how many tickets they'd sold. And it mentioned the support the artist scheme, but it didn't mention how much money they raised through it. So either they haven't calculated it yet, or they're not very happy with it, and they don't want to tell you.
Do they publish kind of what it is between what proportion of tickets go through the fringe box office and what go through their own?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, individual... Actually, I don't know. I mean, that data will exist somewhere, but yeah. I'd have to wade through a lot of websites to try and find it.
I'll see if I can find that. Because, yeah, that'd be interesting. Because obviously, if 80% goes through the fringe box office... then you're only left with 20%, and then only a percentage of that will pay the £2. And so, you know, you're kind of, it's a good gesture, it's moving in the right direction, but it might well not be meaningful enough. But maybe if the Fringe themselves take it up and it's on the main box office next year, then
yeah, it's one of those. It's one of those things about the kind of pathway that a customer takes through a website as well, right? Whereas if you automatically added it on and asked them to take it off, you'd probably get a lot more people paying it. And if the Fringe Society did it, not just these two individual venues, I'm sure it will catch on, and I'm sure other venues will do it, because I think it is a nice mechanism. But it's about inserting it into the ticket buying process in a way that is effective, I suppose.
Yeah, and in terms of kind of finding out about shows, you know, we said there's like 3,700 or somewhere around that kind of thing. Obviously, you will get, for want of a better word, pestered to kind of see various shows and see the kind of things. But I mean, do you feel yourself, you know, what's out there? Is there big chunks of things that you've got no idea that even existed until 20th of August?
Yeah, the truth is that I have a very poor grip on the festival, and everyone has a very poor grip on the festival, because it's too big for any one person to have any real sense of what's going on. I operate in this kind of professional theatre sphere, professional in kind of inverted commas there, where most of the shows I go and see, have got press representatives, they've got PRs that are sending me press releases, they've got a marketing budget, maybe they've got a big theatre or a producer attached to them. So I kind of know about them, I'm told about them, and then I'll go and see them and I'll write about them. Those shows really are the tip of the iceberg. They are nothing compared to the vast bulk of shows that exist beneath the waterline that I never get to see or even hear about. So no is the answer. I don't know what goes on in 95% of the festival. I mean, even the stage probably manages to cover about 200 shows during the festival out of 3,500. That's nothing. That's less than 10%.
Mm. Do you have time during the festival to be a general fan, a punter? Can you go to a show for fun? Is that possible?
Sometimes I go and see theatre shows that people are talking about sometimes, because it's good for me to see them. So that's kind of fun, but it's also kind of job-wise. On the last Sunday, I got a ticket to see Kieran Hodgson, the comedian, and I went to Pleasance Courtyard after I'd seen my last theatre show, and I had a couple of ciders, and I went to that. That was probably the only show. I went to see David O'Doherty as well, I suppose. I could count on one hand the number of shows that I went to see for fun compared to work, which is kind of sad.
I was going to say, you personally wouldn't pick a flyer, you're not in that kind of thing. So it's more, would it be what you see in other publications, word of mouth, or I guess you're saying, you know, it's where you're almost told to go to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, partly it's where I'm told to go. The Scotsman tells me which shows to go and review, so I go and see those. The stage, I have a bit more of a say in it. I can kind of submit a wish list, and most of the shows I can go and see for that. Otherwise, it's just other artists, artists whose work I'm already familiar with. Maybe I've seen a previous show, or producers who I know have picked kind of winners before, or venues. I see a lot of stuff at Summerhall and Pleasance because they're curated, the programs there, and I know there was a little bit of quality control. I think it does behove a journalist writing about the Fringe to stray off the beaten track a bit, and I think I'm quite bad at that, and I should do better. But it's difficult. You don't know which direction to walk in first. You don't know which flyer to pick up first, to be honest.
So one of the previous episodes, we had the two founders of the Camden Fringe. Now, so, you know, that runs pretty much the same time as Edinburgh, so I guess obviously you've got enough on your plate as it is. But do you think that there are other fringes that maybe not as much for theatre, but, you know, hopefully for theatre, that can kind of take on Edinburgh either at the same time or different times of the year. So always still Edinburgh, the pinnacle and almost the be all and end all.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it always will be. I think there is a big conversation happening in Edinburgh within kind of Scottish journalism at the moment and Scottish politics about how much do we value the festival and being careful around it and making sure it's not too expensive to attend as an artist or an audience member, because it's a huge, I mean, for all its flaws, it is a huge cash cow for the Edinburgh economy. It brings in something like £1 billion a year to Edinburgh's economy. The city survives off it. And people say it doesn't end that they're not affected by, that a lot of Edinburgh is not affected by the impact of the fringe, the positive impact of the fringe, but that's nonsense, because you cannot have the world's largest arts festival arrive on your doorstep. The amount of businesses and then businesses that those businesses support, that the festival supports indirectly, is enormous. The city lives off it. And so I think it is important that we do take care of it. We do make sure that it's accessible. We do make sure that it doesn't do damage at the same time. But yeah, I think it's nonsense to say that. It's like saying, oh, does the World Cup not matter to football anymore or something like that? Of course it does. There's nothing even comes close. Even Adelaide doesn't come close to touching Edinburgh in terms of size or scale or diversity or the number of countries represented. There is no other event in the world like it.
Yeah,
there's not going
to
be.
I think, you know, a lot of people I've spoken to, you know, they absolutely love it, but there are still some things. You know, the question is, well, where does the money, you know, there's a lot of money comes in, but an awful lot of it goes out and it necessarily goes to the right people. You know, there's all kind of things about, you know, should people who come in for temporary staff effectively, you know, are they temporary staff? Are they volunteers? There's all those kind of things about paying the, you know, minimum wage and all those kind of things that are
debatable. I'm 100% behind those conversations. Yeah, but to an extent they're debatable. Like yes, people should be, as in, yes, I am completely with that. There are some shocking employment practices that go on at the festival, and I do not think the Fringe Society should let the venues that do not properly employ their staff into the programme at all. And I think there is a lot of money that is siphoned out of Edinburgh by kind of old Etonians that run venue chains. And I would say one organisation that gets away absolutely scot-free is the university, which is, I think I saw, is like the richest university in the country, maybe if not one of the richest universities in the world. And that is built off the back of the Fringe Festival, of being able to rent out its spaces every year. My point, which I probably didn't articulate very well, is that it is a huge driver of the Edinburgh economy and the Scottish economy. Yes. As well. And the amount of work that it generates, the amount of customers that it generates for businesses, and then those businesses then employ other businesses in the Edinburgh area, and those businesses employ other... You cannot quantify the effect of having the world's largest arts festival on your doorstep.
I guess everywhere across the world, your city's name is mentioned constantly in August. And so, yes.
Yeah, you know, and it's a huge driver of like tourism, Edinburgh tourism as well. Like the soft power of Scotland is partly built on the back of the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yes. Yes, and you know, it might be that people will say, well, I don't want to go anywhere near it during August, which, you know, for a lot of people makes a lot of sense, but they'll know that it's the kind of place that, even without the arts festival, that it's the kind of place to go to and somewhere to visit. But it's interesting that you're kind of saying, you know, ticket sales, if not necessarily people, is down. And is there a sweet spot where, you know, like you said, you know, it doesn't have to be so busy that everyone gets price gouged for accommodation, but you still have a vibrant festival?
The festival was half as big even 10 years ago, and it felt great and it was still amazing. It's definitely far too big. I suppose it's just about pulling the right levers to make sure that its decline does not damage, that it's a kind of managed decline that does not damage either the performing arts industry or the Edinburgh economy or the jobs in Edinburgh and that kind of thing. It's kind of like, there has to be the willpower there. Like, where does that willpower come from? If there's so much profit motive embedded in the model of the Edinburgh Fringe, then where is the impetus to shrink? And I can't see it coming.
Yeah. One, really appreciate your time. One last quick question. Well, that's a quick question. Is that, you know, a lot of the time people will talk about the Edinburgh Comedy Festival, and, you know, that probably grids with you, is that how much do people see that it's more than just a load of stand-ups? And do you think that there's enough awareness? I know with people who know the Fringe, yes, but, you know, in the wider UK public, do they think it's just a bunch of stand-ups coming from London to kind of do some gigs for a month?
I have no idea. Probably. I don't know. Probably some people do, some people don't. It's interesting the way it's evolved. I mean, who are the most famous acts associated with the Edinburgh Fringe? Fleabag, you would put in there. in the kind of top five probably, but also Beyond the Fringe, which was comedy but also theatre. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Dead. Tom Stoppard came from the Edinburgh Fringe. And then there's the International Festival as well, but people aren't as aware of that, I suppose. I don't know. Do people associate the Edinburgh Fringe with comedy or theatre? Probably increasingly comedy, I would say. And comedy has overtaken theatre in terms of the size of its section in the programme over the last 10 years. Comedy has outstripped theatre. So it is more of a comedy festival than a theatre festival. But then these boundaries between art forms are porous anyway. I mean, Fleabag was comedy, but it was also theatre.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know is the truth to that.
Okay.
I think probably the its reputation is leaning comedy.
No, fantastic. No, thank you so much for your time. I mean, I've kind of taken up.
Are you sure? I feel like I've waffled on, Dan, about.
No, that's.
I've not really provided any concrete answers to anything.
Well, I guess I think that's a good metaphor for the fringe, to be honest, in that there are no easy answers. There is a lot of difficulty and kind of balances to be made and all the rest of it. But no, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. It's really appreciated.
No worries, fantastic. Dan. It was lovely to chat.
Thanks for listening. There's more details in the show notes about Fergus, his work, and the newsletter that we discussed in the episode. If you enjoyed this, check out our other episodes where we speak to a number of performers about their experiences at the Edinburgh Fringe, as well as creatives in other industries about making creativity pay.